Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Northport, Long Island. A quiet community rocked by reports a teenager was dragged through these woods toward a late-night ritual of death. An eyewitness said the victim, Gary Lowers, was forced to pray to Satan as he was repeatedly stabbed to death. Two young men were arrested. James Troiano was found innocent last month, but his alleged accomplice never made it to trial. Ricky Casso committed suicide in jail the day after his arrest. Despite numerous signs that Castle was into Satanism and rock music associated with devil worship, police steadfastly refused to label this case satanic. The official explanation, a drug-related crime.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me this week is my co-host Rob St. Mary, back from Ohio.
That's right. Hail Satan, but I prefer velvet.
I believe that's pronounced satin.
Ah, yes. I get those two things confused quite a bit.
Not to be confused with sateen. Also along for the ride this week, down the highway to hell, is Josh Gravel of the Arkham Film Society.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Rob. Since I am a projectionist by trade, I've always wondered about this projection booth. Is it a changeover system, or are you guys plottering the prints?
Oh, no platter here, but it's all changeover.
All right.
This week we're talking about Ricky Six, a seldom-seen film from the year 2000, directed by Peter Filardi. It's the story of Ricky Cowan, a kid from the burbs who gets involved in drugs, the occult, and ultimately murder. Pretty much a typical day in high school, at least in mine. I don't know about you guys. Josh, I will admit that I've never heard of this film before, nor had I really even heard of the true crime on which it was based until you told me about it. So tell me how you first came to Ricky Six.
The story kind of goes way back to the 80s. I grew up into heavy metal and stuff. And of course, if anybody was into that kind of thing in the 80s, you always heard at least the urban legend that, you get into this, you get into drugs and Satan, and next thing you know, you're killing people. And parents across the country were afraid of that. Years later, probably the late 90s is when I found out that it was based on an actual event that kind of kickstarted that hysteria. And my real introduction to the story of Ricky, pretty much, was the Jim Van Bever short film, My Sweet Satan. I don't know if either of you have seen that.
Yes, I had to watch that as part of the research for Did Beat at Dawn.
So that was my first introduction to the fact that this was an actual event. And then through a little research I found, years later, I'd come across articles about Ricky Six that were in Fango around the time of his initial festival run, and had looked for the film in vain because, as you know, it's never received an official release. I found a bootleg of it through a gray market source and just loved the film. It's something about the story just connected with me, the style of the film connected with me. Around that same time, I started programming for a local film festival and decided I have to track down this filmmaker and show this film. And I did that in 2006. And that's kind of how we got here. Because ever since then, I pretty much tell anybody that will listen how good this film is and how they have to see it.
I don't know if you've had the chance to read Say You Love Satan, but I actually picked that one up. And it follows along the story pretty much like it was laid out in the book, really. I mean, of course, it has to condense it down to an hour and a half time frame, hour and 45 minutes, I guess. And then it throws in quite a few fantasy sequences. I especially like the ones towards the end. But it does follow along. I mean, the story is that of this guy, Ricky Casso. I remember that he had this whole thing about how you pronounce it in there. And just him and his buddy. It wasn't Tommy in the book, was it? It was Jimmy.
Tommy in the movie, and I believe Jimmy in real life.
Really, Jimmy's kind of the guy that we follow through the whole thing, because I don't think that we could really, well, we're never going to get Ricky's story, but we can get Jimmy's story. And just the way that they kind of, it's really kind of a sad story of just not having anything to do in a suburb and just kind of getting into bad news and just no one really paying attention, no one really, you know, taking the steps. And then when they do try to take the steps, Jimmy's kind of clean for a while. Jimmy, who is renamed Tommy in the movie. And then Ricky is just kind of a sociopath. I mean, he basically knows when he is playing the system and does that all the time. You know, he will tell people anything they want to hear in order for him to get back on the streets, get some more drugs, and just kind of take his role as the Acid King, is what he liked himself to be called. So kind of a messed up story, man. And this was all taking place in a, I believe it was a suburb of in Long Island, if memory serves. And just, yeah, it was kind of a weird tale.
Kind of reminds me, and I mean, obviously I didn't know anything, as you were saying, Mike, about this person or this story until I saw the film and then I started to do a little research on it. But as you were saying as well, Josh, it reminds me of a lot of these stories that we heard when we were kids around sort of that whole, I guess, for lack of a better term, satanic panic of the 80s, with things like, you know, Judas Priest going on trial for their lyrics and possible suicides that were related to that kind of stuff, and how this sort of all fits into that. And then when we talk about sort of like how that era of, you know, music and culture and stuff like that starts to work its way into other films. And the thing that I really like about this one is there's a lot of really interesting tone ideas within this film. And it also leaves me with a lot of questions related to, you know, its completion, its creation, and eventual release or lack thereof.
Yeah, in relation to the Jimmy/Tommy character, he very much comes across as someone that you can relate to. And it really brings you into, kind of sucks you into both the book and the film.
You do get a much better feel for this guy. And I think mostly because it's, he's a little more even keel as we go through, because, you know, Ricky just, I think you point this out in the interview with Peter Filardi that we'll be playing back later. You know, Ricky starts as the character you want to believe in and be friends with, and by the end, you would want nothing to do with this guy. Whereas Tommy Jimmy is a little bit, has a descent, but it's not nearly as far.
I would say with his character, he also probably is the one that the audience can find the peg into. I mean, as sort of Ricky's character sort of slips past reality in a way and gets further and further, as you were talking about, Mike, with some of these fantasy sequences at times, we can relate more to the friend than we can to Ricky as he sort of loses it.
Really, we can't stress enough just how panicked America was at the time. I mean, I remember things on 2020 and just a bunch of news shows and just the way that Satanism, as you know, corrupting the youth of America, was just, it was you know, just really widespread. And you can kind of go back and see some of this now. If you go back and look at some of the documentaries like Paradise Lost, the story of the West Memphis Three, and just how, you know, anyone that was different who might have had any kind of interest in, you know, what would have been considered goth music at the time, or heavy metal, or people that wore black, or who just were, you know, any kind of, you know, interest in the occult or anything, just the way that they were, you know, prosecuted and literally prosecuted in the case of the West Memphis Three. But then even going into something like Capturing the Freedmans, where it's like these incredible tales of, you know, human sacrifice and shit, where it was just like, this is insane. And people were buying into it. And it was this whole idea of, you know, planting stories in kids' heads and just kind of it going beyond any kind of rational thought. And here we go, you know, oh my God, the entire preschool has been invaded by Satanists. And So I don't think that we can really say enough how the story of Ricky Casso fits in with this, you know, insanity of the '80s. And I don't know if it came out of like this kind of sudden oppression of, you know, the Reagan administration or where it was coming from. I mean, I would think if anything, maybe back during the Helter Skelter murders, we might've had more of this kind of, you know, widespread panic about Satanism and the occult, but really it seemed to come out in the mid to early '80s and just how widespread it was. Maybe it was just that, you know, Wasp and Stryper and Rat and all those guys were finally, you know, taking up the top 10 spots on the charts or something, because, you know, we all know that if you play those records backwards, you know, you're going to go right to hell.
Not a Stryper record. They were Christian.
I know. I was throwing that in there just to see if anybody was paying attention. It's not like we are Satan's people or knights in Satan's service.
I remember this was such a big thing that every major daytime talk show would have this as a topic on at least a monthly basis. Are your kids getting into Satan? Are the Satanists in your neighborhood? It's very disconcerting how kind of rampant the fear spread just from a few instances, you know, and even really only, you know, a couple things that can be verified.
And not only that, but I mean, let's move just beyond the idea of teenagers for a minute. I mean, Mike, you referenced a little bit the preschool case, the McMartin preschool case at the time. I mean, that was a 7-year trial. It cost multi-millions of dollars. It was like the longest criminal trial in U.S. history, that supposedly there was this satanic ritual abuse that was going on at this preschool in California. And it just seemed, as you were saying, and I think that maybe that might have to do with sort of the rise of, as you were saying, sort of the moral majority, Jerry Falwell, the religious right sort of coming into its own from the late 70s and the first Reagan presidency, the first term there up until about 84. And it seemed that basically by the mid 80s, when you have, you know, Ozzy doing what he was doing and the whole bat biting incident, that was sort of the pinnacle of it. It was just, if you were into metal, like everyone was looking at you like, you know, when are you going to snap and start, you know, draining the blood of small children?
If you were into Satan, you're a friend of mine. But I guess that kind of plays into, I don't know if it plays into the strengths or the weaknesses of this film, really, because, you know, the movie was, as far as I know, being completed in the year 2000, which was 10, 15 years away from this kind of rampant paranoia. So I'm wondering how effective it would have been in 2000, because here I am seeing it in, 2012? How effective it would have been in 2000 seeing this? And Josh, maybe you can help us out on this one. Can you cast your mind back that effectively to remember how all this stuff was? Or is it a little too late at the time? And then also we have the kind of the aesthetic of the film itself. I mean, I talked a little bit about some of the fantasy sequences, which I think are really well done. But the rest of the film kind of, and I believe you said this in your article, Josh, that you wrote about Ricky Six, was kind of an after school special kind of structure and feel to it.
I'll address the first part when you were saying, you know, how do you think this would have, you know, been received in a way? Whereas the satanic panic was definitely over by that point, I still think that this film would have found a pretty good audience, because we're always dealing in some nature of pop culture with disenfranchised youth that always feel like they don't fit in. And they're always kind of looking for something to be theirs, in a way. So I think there would have been a large audience that would have found this film had it gotten released back then. As far as the look, yes, I have always felt that this overall, my overall take of the aesthetic of this film is like it's an experimental after-school special. Because it deals a lot with the relationships between students. Adults and parents play a very minor role in the film itself. I think, you know, the only adult that you see in more than one scene is Ricky's mother is in a couple scenes with only like two or three lines each. and then there's Pat Pagan, who kind of takes the father figure. It even has a, I wouldn't say plain look to it, because it's very nicely shot, you know, it has a very good, like professional look to it, but the majority of the film, if it's just going to be a conversation or something, does have a plainer look than the rest of it when it takes that more experimental bent towards the fantasy sequences and stuff. So that's why I always say it's like, you get this after-school special, and then all of a sudden, you're kind of thrown through a loop.
The after-school special, the one thing that I noticed when I was watching it is, it does have this TV movie gloss. Like, it looks like it was something that was shot, as you were saying, like, for TV. There's a certain, I don't know if it's the lighting, I don't know if it's the staging, but it does have this throwback quality to what I remember of sort of like TV movie of the week kind of look. And as you were saying, as things kind of ramp up, as we get to, I would say maybe like an hour and 10 in or so, it really starts to get darker and the fantasy sequences become more apparent. And by the time we get to what I've sort of dubbed the wasteland scene, where he's like face to face with the devil and all this, and he's kind of walking through this swamp and there's all this fire at the same time, like that is just an amazing sequence. I mean, it just is very, very interesting to look at. It's very beautiful. And the final shot in the film is really well done. So I'm just really impressed at how he can go from this place of high gloss and almost television movie of the week into something that I would say is comparable to a lot of youth-oriented horror film that you would see at a multiplex.
Well, and I mean, the director, Peter Filardi, did have a background somewhat in youth-oriented horror film, as he was the writer of The Craft and also Flatliners.
You had mentioned the Pat Pagan character, Kevin Gage. I kind of wish there had been a little bit more of him in the movie, because his role in the book, it's minor. Maybe there's just a little bit more of him, but I really like him as a character, at least in the book. Just the way that he has this, like, this medallion, this whole satanic medallion. I think they talk about that in the movie, but there's this whole thing where Ricky wants that medallion and basically just, like, completely emasculates Pat Pagan and takes the medallion, and there's this whole sequence where it's just like, oh my God, you know, you feel so bad for him.
Pat is represented throughout the film as a stronger character. I think more to counteract the kind of tough love character of Ricky's father,
who really doesn't seem to have very much of a role in the book, very much at all, and subsequently much of a role in Ricky's life, really, because it feels like his parents are just completely, you know, bamboozled by Ricky's, you know, kind of play acting.
From a production element in this film as well, the one thing I was impressed by is the soundtrack is really well done. There's a good mix of music that you'll know. I mean, he's got drops from Joy Division and Dio and Iron Maiden, and which sort of leads me to this question of, for myself, why I didn't know about this film and why hasn't the film been released? And I'm sure we get into that a little bit, but the first thing that I thought of was maybe there was a rights issue in terms of all this music that he had that maybe he couldn't clear, and that's part of the reason why it's been held up.
From what I've been able to put together from, because at this point I've talked to, I think, four people involved behind the scenes in the production of the film, and it seems that a good chunk of the completion money was secured from the Royal Bank of Canada, and that was contingent on the foreign sales of the film, is where they were supposed to get their money back, from what I understand. Now, the person who arranged that, something happened with their relationship to either the film or with the bank. I think one person had mentioned that they may have actually passed away. I've never fully gotten a straight answer on that one. But either way, something happened with his relationship to the film and the bank, and the bank has seized the assets of the film. And they have the negative and the answer print. And apparently, if anybody does want to get the film, you have to deal with them. They apparently don't want to let the film go very cheaply. Besides that, there are still rights clearances that need to be gotten on the film. If you were to pay off the bank, to release this on DVD, because the rights that they got for the music was a smaller clearance just so they could do festivals. I guess that's the short version of it.
And to be honest, that's really not unusual. As a filmmaker myself, and when I did my movie back in the late 90s, we would often have this discussion between, when it came to music rights, do you get full rights or do you just get a festival license? And the idea was is that you would get a festival license, you would show it, and then when you get distribution and you have enough money, then you can go back and negotiate out the rights long term. And I've seen this happen with other independent films where someone will have a festival license and then the sales don't go the way that they wanted, or they didn't raise enough money, and then they either have to go in, pull the music out, or just put it in the closet and never release it because they can't afford to do anything with it. And the thing that I was kind of amazed by when I was watching this is that from a production standpoint and from a story standpoint, it's a very strong film. And I think that there's enough elements within the film that if someone were to take it and try to get it distributed, it would work. The problem is we're now looking at it 12 years on, and it's not to say, as my good friend Lloyd Kaufman has said about film, you're not selling produce, so it doesn't rot on you. You can still have viability on a product that's 20, 30 years old on a film. But I think as we go further and further away, as you were saying, Mike, from this era and the people who are connected to this era, then it makes it harder, I think, to try and sell something like this, because it is so sort of specifically niched into a certain era and a certain time and people who would be interested in that.
It reminds me a little bit of the episode that we did on The Woman Chaser, which played at a lot of festivals, got some good buzz going. And yeah, same thing. If they were to release that today, the music rights would be astronomical. And it was probably the same thing. They had the festival rights, but not the full-fledged DVD rights. So now, yeah, if we were to try to release Ricky Six, I would imagine they would have to go in and replace everything. Maybe Ricky Six could go for an update, you know, have some of these modern bands go back and cover, you know, Rainbow in the Dark or some of these songs so that we can hear them done by, I don't know, Korn or one of those stupid bands now.
Which really isn't that far off, because you often find in the case of things like the Beatles and the licensing of the Beatles music, that stuff is so cost prohibitive that what you do is you just have someone cover a song from the Beatles and it's cheaper, or you have someone do, and I think I heard this in Ricky Six, a song that sounds like something like that. Because I swear that within this movie, I heard something that sounded like a well-known Metallica tune, and I was listening to the melody of it, and I go, that sounds like this, but actually it was not. So it's the use of sound-alike in order to give you a flavor of a certain concept as opposed to the actual music itself. Because as we were saying, you know, music rights can be very cost prohibitive.
I know that when this did do festivals, it was very well received. It won awards at numerous festivals, was written up in numerous magazines. There have been companies who have approached the bank trying to purchase the film. I know Peter has cited at least one company that just flat out offered them $1 million for the film, and they're just unwilling to negotiate on it. I'm not sure how much they actually want for it, but they seem kind of stuck on holding on to the film until they get exactly what they want.
You know, some money is better than no money, I would think.
You know, I guess they would rather just have it rot away and not give anyone an opportunity to actually see it and make something on it. And like I was saying, I mean, I don't know. I mean, if this thing ever gets released, say 20 years from now, do you think there would be any interest? Because, I mean, obviously for us who grew up in that era and remember that era, a movie like this is going to make sense. I don't know if you're going to show it to 20-year-olds 20 years from now, how much you're going to have to explain about the Satanic Panic, or is it just an interesting little film about a guy who's losing touch with reality?
I think Josh hit on the head when he was saying that, you know, teenage disenfranchisement is a fairly universal and forever theme. I guess just that this is kind of decorated in the trappings of Satanism and heavy metal. It's going to kind of be a time capsule because of that. But, you know, unless kids suddenly stop listening to music that their parents hate and not taking drugs, then we would definitely have a problem on our hands.
When I got in touch with everybody and I showed the film in 2006, we showed it as a midnight movie, and I knew this was going to be a hard sell because it's a film that not only had nobody really heard of, but even fewer people had seen. So I made flyers that were I had red flyers and yellow flyers, and just in big, bold, plain block lettering on them, it said Metal, Drugs, Satan, and Murder. And then underneath, I put like a small and basic description of the film, you know, that it was made by Peter Filardi and what else he had worked on, and then the date and time information for the screening. It was actually at the cable car where you did your event in Providence, Mike. And we had, I think, about 45 people show up to see this. And it ranged from people in about our age group to like college kids that were like 18 and 20. And for the most part, everybody loved the film. From that, you know, perspective, it seemed to play to like across the whole audience pretty well, you know, even the people of different age groups. So I think, you know, it, whenever it does get released, it'll find its audience.
All right. So on that note, we're going to take a break and come back with an interview with writer-director Peter Filardi.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at AdamandEve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out AdamandEve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at AdamandEve.com.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the Cult Movie Podcast, proudly resents, and you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know, it's messed up, right?
Hello, this is Mike from the Badasses Boobs and Bodycounts.com website and podcast. At the BB&BC website, I post thoughts, or reviews if you will, of lesser known action, exploitation, and horror films. In the all-new BB&BC podcast, I talk about films of the same genre, but usually with a guest host. We discuss films such as...
And I'm going to let them know that Dolomite is back on the scene. I'm going to let them know that Dolomite is my name, and f***ing up motherfuckers is my game.
Dolomite, which falls into the badass category. We also look at films like...
I should have taken you for a stone-cold dyke from the start.
Screw you!
Pervert. In the boobs category. In the body counts category, we cover films like...
What's going on here? What do you think you're doing?
We're having an orgy. What's it to you?
We're enjoying the fun.
You all think you're so smart, don't you? Well, you ain't. You ain't so damn smart after all. You just wait and see.
Somebody's always trying to spoil our fun.
But we have a devil of a good time.
Satan's cheerleaders. And last but not least, we also look at films such as...
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
We only want to know where Valley Lodge is.
Which way do we go?
Manos, the Hands of Fate, in the Everything Else category. The BB&BC website is located at badassesboobsandbodycounts.com, and the BB&BC podcast can be downloaded from the iTunes Store, the BB&BC website, and is also now available on Stitcher Smart Radio. Just do a search on BB&BC podcast to start listening.
Before we even get to Ricky Six, you know, looking at your filmography, I'm curious how you kind of came to writing.
Well, let's see. I think like most or many people, I backed into writing. I was an undecided major at Boston University and met a kid who was studying film and was kind of astounded to hear that a person could go to college to study movies. So I switched my major my junior year and then finished out my education with 2 years of their film school, which was pretty rudimentary at the time, mostly shooting Super 8 films and criticizing movies, film history, stuff like that. I thought I wanted to be a director of photography, but got a job in a small ad agency and kind of quickly figured out that the quickest way to get closer to the story and closer to what I was interested in was writing. And so I became a copywriter and then a screenwriter. I drove out to California and with a couple of spec Miami Vice scripts I wrote at night after work, and came out here to try to sell them. And was able to get an agent with them, and they didn't sell, but I was able to write a MacGyver that sold, and that got me started. And and then I wrote Flatliners, which was a spec feature and sort of my entree into Hollywood, or at least features. And so I would have to say I sort of backed into it.
Yeah, I saw Flatliners at the theater and had a blast watching it, especially when little Billy Mahoney would kick the shit out of Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah, people still like that. A bit of film trivia about that, I think, is, you know, if you think back, Donald Sutherland was chasing around a little guy in a red sweatshirt in Don't Look Now, or Don't Look Back, and I'm quite sure that Joel Schumacher dressed Billy Mahoney in a red sweatshirt as a sort of an homage to Kiefer's dad.
I don't know if we were supposed to, but we were really rooting for Billy.
No, you weren't supposed to be rooting for that, Mike.
Damn.
I failed miserably. Clearly, I failed. You were supposed to feel sorry for my protagonist.
I wouldn't blame you.
Right.
So you went from Flatliners. Did you go right to The Craft, or did you do stuff in between?
Actually, I was researching Ricky Six, and hence doing a lot of reading about Satanism and things like that, when a producer came by and said he wanted to do either a haunted house project or a witchcraft project. And I said, well, I've actually been reading a lot about Satanism and witchcraft. I'm really kind of into that these days. So from that relationship came The Craft. And then after that, and then I got sidetracked for a number of years with other stuff before I circled back to someone asked if there was a little script I had that I might like to direct, and that was Ricky Six, because it was smaller and manageable.
So how did you, as you put it, get into Satanism?
I'm like so many people, probably a child of Stephen King, you know. I think the first book my grandmother ever gave me, the first adult book, was Salem's Lot, and when I was 12, and I think I just caught the bug for that type of story, suburban horror, small town horror. I was from a small town in New England, and ghosts, vampires, Satan, witches, it all works together.
I was just going to ask how you got exposed to the whole story of Ricky Casso.
I just happened to be in a bookstore, a local bookstore out here, and the paperback had a chrome finish to the cover, and a photo of Ricky right after he'd been arrested, all wide-eyed and wired-looking, and with a title like Say You Love Satan. I just picked it up and really was fascinated with the story. I saw it as, like Flatliners and like The Craft, again, it was sort of the story of a seeker, you know, a character who's looking for more out of life than meets the eye, looking for that little wrinkle of magic, which I'm attracted to as well. And he just happened to take it down a very dark path. You know, I saw Ricky Casso as kind of a pioneer of the whole teen Satan phenomenon. He was kind of really one of the first to mix the music with the hallucinogenics and the theology, and you know, and come up with, you know, what we later, you know, almost became somewhat of a cliche, you know, the teen Satanist. But really, he was one of the first, and he took it all the way to the end.
So you read the story, you see this. What's the thing that says, okay, I want to turn this into a movie? What was that kind of tipping point for you?
Honestly, I thought it was the greatest story ever. I thought it was sort of a buddy story, but instead of a girl getting in the middle of the two buddies, there was a theology, which was Satanism. I saw it as the story of one kid who was maybe picked on or weaker, who embraces this theology and the drugs and becomes stronger, partnered with his friend, he's able to grow into all this under the safety and the umbrella of his tough friend, who, once the theology and the drugs and everything come in, starts to decline. And so the two are moving in opposite directions until the end, when they're, you know, miles apart. I just thought it was really a fascinating story. I optioned the book and wrote a script based on it. And, you know, you sort of do that, especially a story like this. You never think you're going to sell it to any studio or it's ever going to be, you know, a huge commercial venture. You just sort of do it. It becomes a bit of a passion project.
I know you mentioned that it was a producer that asked if you had any small scripts. Were there any problems because of the subject matter getting some, like, a production company on board with actually making the movie?
Well, the first people to show interest was Oliver Stone's company. He was doing a slate of 5 low-budget films, and I think he was maybe 2 into it, and or 3 into it, and I was going to be the next one up, and John Ridley had just done one, I think, called Cold Around the Heart, but then for one reason or another, Oliver pulled the plug on the whole venture and stopped making producing these low-budget films. I suppose I probably just put it back in the closet until my attorney actually said, hey, he knew some producers out of New York who were interested in doing a low-budget film and introduced me, and then they read it, and they were intrigued as well and taken by the material. And so Juan Carlos Zapata and Bill D'Alessandro, a couple guys from New York, produced the film.
When it came to adapting the book into a movie, I mean, you do have two very strong protagonists in here. How did you balance between the two when it came to actually telling the film story versus the written word?
But the book is all from Jimmy's point of view. He told the story. He's the survivor, and Ricky's dead, of course. But really, the more intriguing character is Ricky. So you have to try to fill in the blanks of his life with what we have. And that was a real tricky part of this adaptation, trying to fill in blanks and not misrepresent the guy too much. That was a big challenge.
Did you have to take special care to make him like a likable character? Because the character starts out as somebody that you really like, and then by the end, you're kind of, you no longer want to stand side by side with. Or did that come naturally to make him a sympathetic character at first?
That came naturally for me. I think even when I read the book, I mean, I don't think he started out as an evil person. I think he was, you know, as much a creature of his environment as the rest of us. And then I think that, you know, he had some psychological issues. And I think being ostracized or a social outsider or a bit of a pariah, and then mixed with the hallucinogenics, everything just came together to make this explosive, volatile kid. And I actually saw his story in 4 acts, and I broke it down into pretty much earth, wind, water, and fire. When we first meet him, he's sort of a grounded kid who, you know, flogs away at his school and his friendships like the rest of us, picked on by bullies and stuff, very grounded. Wind is when he discovers the theology of Satanism and the power and the magic of LSD and hallucinogenic drugs. Water is when, you know, he's abusing them and he loses the love of his life, his girlfriend, starts to get sick. The drugs and the lifestyle are starting to drag him down. He also is challenged by another kid who we call Tweezle, sort of wants to sort of supplant Ricky and take his place among the kids as, you know, the acid king. And then the last act is fire, when, you know, more or less in an act of desperation and anger and frustration, he lashes out and one night at a bonfire commits sort of the ultimate sacrifice for his dark master and his capricious god, hoping that he'll finally get his just deserves or his just rewards. So that's sort of how I, you know, it just seemed like such a classical, fascinating arc and story of a kid's rise and fall that's how I saw it, and that's what attracted me to it. And I think if you watch the film, you'll see in the palettes and the colors we chose, clothes, lighting, cars. You'll see it in sort of imagery. You'll see that earth, wind, water, fire progression in the film.
And that actually plays into one thing that I have always talked to people about with the film, how the film is not like a real action-packed film. It's definitely got... It's more grounded in drama, but the film has a visual element to it that really captures you. How much pre-planning went into the general visual look of the film beforehand?
I would say tons. I was introduced to a great Mexican director of photography, Rodrigo Prieto, who had never done an American film, but who has since gone on to do big films like Brokeback Mountain.
He just did Argo.
Ah, see, I didn't know that. I haven't seen that yet. He's great. He's a great guy, and he's very, very talented. So I went down to Mexico City, hung out with him at his house for a while, a weekend, and we talked about, broke down the script and talked about many visual aspects to it. And he brought on a friend of his who was a Mexican production designer and had won the equivalent of their Academy Award for production design. And I saw one of his films and was blown away. So these guys brought with them, you know, that Gabriel Garcia Marquez sensibility, that magical realism that, you know, that I saw in the story and wanted to bring out in the story. You know, I didn't want to just shoot it straight forward. I wanted it to sort of be as magical as the world Ricky was trying to step into.
Let's talk a little bit more about the production. I mean, why was it shot up in Canada? How did that come about?
At the time, the exchange rate, it was a lot cheaper to shoot up there. And we were also able to bring in a Canadian producer and some Canadian money. And so it's all sort of government incentives. And we shot on the east coast of Canada, where they don't get a lot of production. A dollar goes a long way up there. So that's why we ended up there.
Yeah, because I have to say, the locations look beautiful.
They're great. Yeah, you know, they're sort of in keeping with Northport, or, you know, at that time in the 70s. I mean, if you want something to look like the 1970s, go to eastern Canada. You don't have to do too much, really.
And how did the casting come about? Because it's a really strong cast, too.
We cast mostly in Los Angeles, but the kids are from all over. And I had a great casting director, Sarah Katzman, who was a friend. She found Vincent and Chad. Emmanuel Shariki was from Canada. I don't know. I think we were her first American film, too. Of course, she's gone on to do a lot of stuff, Entourage and covers of Maxim magazine and all this stuff. So, yeah, it was pretty much put together here among the kids. We saw tons of kids. Casting Ricky was so, what a challenge, finding the right kid for that.
What were you looking for in particular with him?
You know, a hard rock vulnerability coupled with potential to just, to be evil, to turn, to make that arc. Vincent really brought it all. I thought he was great.
Do you remember where in the casting process he was? Was he an early bird, or did it take forever to find him?
Forever. I think we saw over 100 kids before we found Vincent. It's funny, you wouldn't know it looking at him in Mad Men. But, you know, he just, or even his earlier stuff like Masterminds, his Disney type of stuff. But, boy, he's a complex guy, and he really can bring all that to the screen.
I really enjoyed Kevin Gage as Pat Pagan, too.
He was a latecomer. Couldn't find anyone to play that part, and they wanted me to cast a Canadian, and couldn't find anybody. And a friend of mine knew Kevin and said, you should really use Kevin. I thought about it. I was like, wow, you know, the guy from Heat, that fantastic biker he played in Heat. And so we called him, and he said, sure. And he jumped on a plane and came up with his golf clubs, I think. And he was wonderful. You know, he did the campfire scene. And it's all sort of one, when he did the master, the one long take where he's regaling the kids with stories and spooking Tweezel. He did his take, and there was this hushed silence among the whole crew, and then they all burst into spontaneous applause. It was amazing. They were just blown away. The guy was great. I think back, I say, wow, those are the nights that, you know, movie making is so fun.
Yeah, was it a fairly easy shoot for you? I mean, this was your directing debut, correct?
Yeah, I would say not. It wasn't particularly easy. It was exhilarating, and so I was never tired. I don't think I ever sat down. I was always on the move, but there were too many locations in the script. If I were to craft another low-budget film, or if I were to ever give anyone advice, really, really cut back on the locations. Don't spread the story so wide. Keep it tighter and deeper. You know, you get caught up in all these locations. A lot of it ends up on the cutting room floor. It's just, you know, a terrible waste of time and money.
Many of these standout scenes would be the kind of more hallucinatory scenes. Was there anything specifically, like film-wise or art-wise, that you drew on in those scenes, or was it purely something that you had envisioned from reading passages in the book, you know, maybe from things that Ricky had said or something?
Some of it was drawn from, not really so much, some from the book, but not so much. Some of the dialogue of the campfire scene, of course, is from the book, most of that. But as far as the visual hallucinogenic stuff, I mean, you know, I felt compelled to do a bit of personal research, and so I did that. I knew plenty of other people who had done similar research, so you could talk to them. I felt like tripping and being high like that is a very singular experience. You know, you're really in your own head. So I tried to shoot a lot of those scenes are shot, if you watch them again, there are no two shots. I didn't want to do two shots. It's because there are no two shots when you're tripping. You know, it's you and it's your point of view. And so a lot of it is, that's how I shot it, from Ricky and Ricky's point of view. And I think that sort of contributes. It's a subtle thing, but I think it contributes to the feeling of you know, of being high. You know, another film that did it later, better than me, of course, was Thin Red Line. I love Thin Red Line because war, like drugs, is a very singular experience, at least to Terrence Malick. And if you look at those guys, it's not a war movie where it's the ensemble buddy thing, and there's the Joker and the guy who can find everything and the guy from New York and the Southern gentleman, you know. It's everybody just, there is no group. Everybody's going through it on their own, in their own head, trying to survive. And it's very personal and very intense. And so maybe that was sort of some of the visual style I was trying to bring. And then also make it magical, you know, make it fun in a way. Because you have to remember that Ricky saw this world, saw this alternate reality, and loved it, was attracted to it. Saw magic in it, saw beauty, and saw a gateway to power and personal development. So he had a good time there.
Could you speak a little bit about the hell sequence? Because it's very minimal in nature in certain ways, because it's just a natural setting. But it's one of the creepiest things I've ever seen.
Thanks. You know, I had designed something completely different. I thought that Ricky would climb into a tree after he killed Tweezle, and he would climb down this tree and end up in a whole underground world of tree people and tree creatures and maybe a tree orgy going on, and he would meet Satan there. You know, a very old, rooty, you know, god made of roots and gnarly and stuff. But it quickly became clear that that was, you know, way too expensive and way out of control. And we happened to be scouting around up in Canada. We were driving with the production designer, Jose Luis Aguiar, and we'd passed this swamp a couple times. And we always said, wow, how creepy is that swamp? You know, it's this wonderful swamp of dead roots. And it was really his idea. He said, you know what, that's hell right there. That's our hell. And I was like, holy smokes, you're right. So we went to this old swamp at night with all these roots, dead gnarly roots, stumps sticking out, I'm sorry. I guess it had all been logged. We probably lit 200 small fires all over the place, and we had a crane, and we had a guy in a Satan suit crouched atop a tree which we built, fake tree and tree stump, and then Vincent Kartheiser, ever the good sport, started wading through the the leech-infested, freezing cold water, covered in blood, holding his knife. It was a great night. It was another great night in filmmaking. It was really fun.
Of course, I need to ask why Ricky Six isn't available.
It's hard to even say now anymore why it's not available. You know, it's you know, you have first-time director who makes does a few good things and makes mistakes, and then you have a first-time producer who does some great things and makes mistakes. And so I would say it was sort of a, you know, just a collection of misfortune that the film never got past the festival stage. You know, there were some offers, but some people thought maybe the money wasn't right, and the financing of films, the bonding, the banks' role, it's a little bit of a Byzantine arrangement to try to get this film made in the first place. And it's also sort of relationships and arrangements and deals that, you know, people tend to keep the filmmaker away from or isolated from or ignorant of. And so I can't really say that I know everything anymore. I thought I did it one time, but I really don't anymore. I can't really point any fingers.
So I guess backing up just a little bit, it did get festival releases. Where did it play and what was the reception?
The film premiered at the Fantasia Festival in Montreal, and it won an audience prize, third prize for Best International Feature. And then it played at Fanta Sporto in Rome and Fanta Something in Portugal and another couple of festivals in Europe. And then it didn't play again for probably 10 years, I would say, till Josh Gravel looked me up and dug it up and showed it at his Rhode Island International Festival of Horror. And
it was 6 years, because we showed it in 2006. Okay. It was actually part of our marketing gimmick.
Okay. Oh, yeah, there you go.
It hadn't been shown in 6 years.
Yep. Ricky 666 and 6. So that's really about it.
So is it caught up like in completion bond hell, or?
Yeah, it is. It's caught up in, the bank owns the film. I've looked into it. To get the film out, the bank is open to it, but you would still have to pay for some of the music rights that are in the movie. Some of them, they weren't paid. And so the film, you would either have to pay those off, or you would have to, go back to the original tracks and remix the film, which I've also looked into, but I can't find the original tracks. You know, they're probably in the bank somewhere, but the bank hasn't really been returning my phone calls lately. So I kind of gave up, just kind of moved on. I think my wife got tired of hearing about it.
That is quite a motivating factor.
You know, it was very disappointing, and you can only wallow in disappointment so long, and you gotta move on.
You must have given yourself kind of a time limit and said, okay, you know, there's a certain point where you say, you know, I gotta, you know, pull myself up by my bootstraps and move on. What did you do after that?
I fell into television. I came back to California and was offered a blind pilot deal by the Henson Company and wrote my first television pilot, which was sort of a Romeo and Juliet witch story that sold to Fox. And that launched me on 10 years of television writing, mostly horror, which was also very fun. I got to adapt Salem's Lot for TNT, and I adapted Cold Heart Canyon by Clive Barker for TNT again. And so I got to work with Clive and indirectly with Stephen King, with Whitley Strieber. I did Wolfen. I did a bunch of original stuff. So, and then Nightmares and Dreamscapes. I did an episode of that. And so that's how that's how I worked my way over and, past the disappointment of Ricky Six. And now I just wrote a low-budget thriller feature with my brother, who's also a screenwriter. And that's out now, and we're hoping that, maybe that'll get some traction or find a home somewhere.
It's so great that you came back to Salem's Lot, since that kind of put you on the road.
Oh, my God. It was so poetic. It really was. It was really life full circle, you know, to actually have the privilege to adapt, you know, a book which, you know, I just think is on par with Frankenstein or any other book, and certainly a pillar of American horror. And I loved it. It was a great experience. I had to take some license to update it and to make it, they wanted to do 4 hours, and it needed to really move, you know. If you've seen the pace of television, I mean, this is back in the days of, like, The Shield, where, you know, you squeeze a lot of story into an hour. So I added a few things and combined a few things, and some loyal Stephen King fans were outraged when they saw it and thought that I had overstep my boundaries, but Stephen King himself loved it, thought it was great, so much so that he switched his deal from ABC to TNT and started doing stuff there. He just liked the way we had handled his material. So, you know, whenever you're adapting someone else's work, you're kind of working for an audience of one, and at least when it's Stephen King. And so that he was happy to me was really gratifying.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. It was great getting to hear from Peter Filardi about his film, Ricky Six. And, of course, we're joined this week by Josh Gravel. Now, Josh, not only beyond this film, but you're in with the Arkham Film Society. Can you kind of explain what that's all about?
The Arkham Film Society grew out of my work on film festivals here in the Providence area. And it is essentially myself, my friends Scott and Rick, and we kind of trying to take our love of cult films of all genres to the film-going audience through screenings of mostly cult horror films, but we've branched out. We've shown Night of the Hunter. We helped Brown program a free public screening series in which we screen things like Jurassic Park and Yojimbo and Singing in the Rain. So we try to branch out to everything, but our kind of home base is always going to come back to horror. We try to do most of our screenings on 35mm. In between those, we do program some smaller events that we do digital projection, and those are usually films that we just can't find prints for or that are too obscure for us to forgo the cost of getting prints and booking a larger venue for them.
So where can folks go to find out more about what you guys are screening and your schedule and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, easy. You can go to the arkhamfilmsociety.blogspot.com, and Arkham is A-R-K-H-A-M. You can also search for the Arkham Film Society on Facebook. We have both a page that you can like and a group that you can join. All three of those areas are kept up to date on what we're doing. And like I said, it's about one event a month. Occasionally we take months off if we are doing work with larger festivals, because sometimes we are brought in to program or just kind of consult and do a couple events at different festivals in the area.
What do you have planned coming up? Anything interesting you're excited about?
Yep, the next thing we have is going to be Friday, December 14th. We're doing our salute to the 80s slasher. And we've chosen two lesser-known films, Madman and Final Terror.
Where do you guys screen?
Right now, we use a couple of different venues. Our 35mm events are at the Granoff Center for the Arts, which is a brand-new state-of-the-art arts building that's owned by Brown University. And they have a 210-seat theater there with full 35 capability. So we do a lot of our larger events there. There's a place in downtown Providence called the Empire Black Box, which is just a little black box theater. And we bring a digital projector in there and they hang a screen. And that's where we do our smaller digital events. And we hope to be doing some work again with the historic Columbus Theater. It's the oldest theater in the state. And they were closed for a few years because of some fire code issues. And they are actually finally reopening this weekend. And we're already in talks with them about doing a couple of 35mm events there in their big theater.
Okay, that's all we have time for this week. Thanks again for stopping by, Josh, and thanks for everyone for listening. For more about the Arkham Film Society, we'll be posting the links over at our website, projection-booth.com. And between you and me, we'll even have a link to YouTube where you can see Ricky Six, the film we've been talking about this week.
Hail Satan.